So I guess we could begin by you just, if you would, tell me a little bit about how you got into the community where you lived at. And which community was that?
Yeah, well, it was the Kansas Zen Center. We founded the Zen Center in 1978, my wife and I. And at first, meetings were in our house. And then, no, not this house, but another house in town here in Lawrence. And then we adopted a child, and we had to move the Zen Center out of our house. At that time, it was not any kind of communal group. So we rented a place downtown, and we tried a few other arrangements. And then finally, a group of us decided to buy an old house near the university and make it into a communal Zen Center. There were six of us who actually entered into a legal agreement to co-own this building and so forth. Two couples, so my wife and I, and then Dennis and Carol Duermeyer, and Frank Norman, and Jim Binger. And Jim Binger eventually went on to become a monk, and he's now the abbot of the Quantum School of Zen, International School of Zen, with which we're affiliated. That was in 1982 that we bought the house. It was a very large old Victorian house, greatly in need of renovation. And so we entered into a long-term renovation project while we were all living there. And began the regular schedule of Zen practice every morning, every night, and retreats about every other month, the weekend retreats. So that's how we started. And then the Zen Center stayed in that location for 6 years. But under the various stresses that developed in the community, eventually we sold that house. We sold it to the Duermeyers, and it's now their family house, and they were one of the original members. And now we have, we bought another house, which is where we are now. But that house is not yet anyway developed into what you would really call a communal residential situation. So I take it that you're interested in that early communal enterprise when we all lived together.
Right. Can you tell me a little about that house in relation to the Quantum Zen Center? And the philosophy behind your community?
Yeah. Well, the Zen Center is called the Kansas Zen Center, and the house is the Quantum, or rather the school is the Quantum School of Zen. So that school of Zen was founded by a Korean Zen master, Zen Master Sung San, who came to this country in the early 70s, Providence, Rhode Island, the area around Brown University. And the first Zen Center in our school was an old house near Brown University, and a number of university students living together and observing this practice schedule. So I'm just going to refer to him as Sun Sunim, which is a Korean title, simply means Zen Master. That's how we refer to him. Actually, now Dae Sun Sunim. Senior. He looked around and he saw in Providence and other places that he visited this communal model that had developed, which is in this country, and which is the subject of the study that you're a part of. And he saw there an opportunity to graft this what had originally been a monastic model in Korea and China, so forth, of Zen Buddhism onto something that had evolved in this country, this communal experience. So the idea is what he called together action. So everyone would live together, have meals together, and observe a practice schedule. And the living together was itself part of the practice. It wasn't simply for the convenience of the practice. It too was the spiritual practice. He always compared it to washing potatoes. If you wash the potatoes one by one, and it takes a long time to get the potatoes clean, but maybe you're familiar with this metaphor. You put them in a big pot all together and stir them with a big stick, then the potatoes rub against each other and so become clean. And so by the friction of our karma rubbing against each other, a kind of cathartic effect is produced. So the communal experience was very much a part of the practice. The practice itself, Zen Buddhism, depends heavily on a regular schedule of meditation, which in our school includes prostrations, chanting, and sitting meditation, morning and evening, 7 days a week, for an hour to 2 hours each morning and each evening, and longer periods. Once a month. These longer periods, these intensive retreats, we call Yongmeng Zhongjin, which I'm sure you could translate. But, which we translate as intense effort, courageous resolve, something like that. Those originally in our school were very interesting in terms of this living together. The schedule then was 24 hours nonstop. So you would begin at 4:30 in the morning and continue for 24 hours with only very brief rest periods and not any sleeping at all. So whatever rest you took had to be sitting up. Then at 4:30 in the morning, well, then it was time for regular morning practice on the daily schedule, so you would do that. So actually you would go, I guess, 26 hours. And then, you'd go about your day's business. Those were usually on a weekend, so I suppose it was possible for people to just crash. That was only in the very early years and was actually no longer observed when we started here in 1978. But we've tried it from time to time here. And it's a little different from, that schedule is a little different even from the intensity of ordinary retreats, where indeed you're doing everything together in this communal schedule, but you're literally completely together for 24 hours, except for going to the bathroom. Now you're side by side, you do everything together, such rest that you take, you even take that together, the work periods, and so forth. So that always had, that caught my attention as something that I think we should still do, done a limited amount of it. At any rate, this together action with this strong communal direction, which is basic to all Buddhism, find your true self and save all beings. That direction is very, very strong. That is the heart of the philosophy of Zen meditation. And that's the philosophical basis of our Zen centers.
Can you share some of those experiences you had here with regards to the frictions that you spoke about?
Sure. When we first moved in together, there were two families, each with one child, small babies, and two bachelors. So we were all living together. And we had different degrees of experience with the practice. And we were trying to be egalitarian. No one was going to take charge. But those of us who were more experienced just assumed that, well, we would do things as they were done elsewhere in Zen centers in our school. And we simply laid this out for the other people. But we soon discovered that there were going to to be various degrees of understanding and of involvement in the schedule. So for instance, when we explained the early morning practice the first time, one of the women said, "Oh, how nice it will be to wake up to the sound of chanting." We said, "No, that's not the idea. You're actually there doing the chanting." So there was a little bit of a problem from the beginning. And then quite naturally, family matters very soon took precedence over the schedule, especially when you have small children. And then some of us we all had different work schedules, our outside jobs, whatever we did, and it was very hard to have communal meals. So a wife, for instance, would insist that the meal be delayed until her husband could get home. But that might be the time for evening practice. And so, for instance, when a visitor would come, that is someone else who's experienced practice in our school, he would say, "This is amazing. This is the only Zen center I've ever been to where the evening meal happens at the same time as evening practice. You know, that's very unusual." So that was one form of stress. The other had to do with different styles of child rearing. Yeah, there were two families, and even within the individual family, sometimes you know the parents wouldn't agree. So you had four parents and two children, and we didn't agree really on techniques, methodologies, philosophies of child rearing. So that caused some conflict. Then there was extensive renovation going on the whole time we were trying to develop this practice. So if you've ever lived in a place that's been renovated and the work is going on for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, there's always plaster and dust all over the place, and you're in the midst of a construction site and it's noisy and, you know, and so forth. That added to the stress. Then we all had different sorts of jobs, and so we couldn't participate equally in the work. So some people felt that, you know, others weren't pulling their weight.
Were you doing the renovations yourselves?
We were doing all ourselves, yes. We didn't, I don't think we ever hired anyone to do it. A beautiful old house, and we loved working on it, but everything, the whole house, every room from the basement up to the roof, everything had to be redone. So we were trying to do that and observe this very rigorous practice schedule, which is not easy under the best of circumstances. So what with this renovation going on and various schedules that people had, different levels of commitment to family and to the meditation practice, of course the unmarried men, no problem for them, you know, they could practice all they wanted. Then people, you know, when they get into a practice like this at the beginning are typically very enthusiastic, and then their enthusiasm wanes, and so they're not coming to practice on a regular basis. Meanwhile, other people have heard about the house and they would like to move in and take advantage of living there. We did have room for always, besides these core people, maybe one or two or three other people to move in. So you had new people moving in all of the time as well. What the basic problem was is we didn't have any operating rules, really. Now, at any of our major Zen centers, there's a handbook for residents, and everything is completely laid out. Exactly what the practice is, how much you have to participate in it, what your role in the house is, and you know, so everything goes much more smoothly now. But we were trying to work this out for ourselves. So, in some sense, it's a typical experience in any communal, living situation. But here, there with the added stresses of the constant renovation and the rigorous practice schedule. On the other hand, the practice schedule was something, the practice itself was something we were all deeply committed to. So this gave us a strong common direction and did keep us together. But things actually began to fall apart over the issue of children. And my wife and I discovered that our child was sick all the time. And it turned out that he had various dust and mold allergies. So living in this old house with all this construction going on was just was very bad for his health. So we moved out. And we didn't discuss it much. We simply announced. We gave the reason. We said, we can't do this. Our child's health is at stake here. And we're going to be moving out, you know, as soon as we can find another place. And that's what we did. The Zen Center survived that and continued for another 4 years in that location. But it always was struggling because things had never been clarified. And in fact, the Zen Center is still in that situation. In terms of our current house, which has four people living in it. And because of our early experience was so traumatic, really, we decided that in this new location, we would simply rent out the house to people. We didn't care if they practiced or not, because the meditation room is completely separate, you know, from the house. We didn't want to deal with all of this. So we went to the opposite extreme. Now finally we're coming back to the model of a residential Zen center, but with a lot more wisdom and experience, and also the cumulative experience of other Zen centers in our school. So we're about to set up what we think is a proper residential model, but just for four people, so it's on a small scale.
So what's going to happen to those people who are currently living there?
Well,
may not be Buddhists or practicing?
Well, they are, in fact. We've been slowly moving in this direction, actually. And so a few years ago, we said, well, at least you have to, sometimes practice Zen, if you live here. Now we're moving to a practice schedule, and so forth. And it's all being worked out, and they will have some input into the rules, but we're just going to go ahead with it. And they'll be given 6 months. Notice. These rules will be in effect in 6 months. You have 6 months to decide you're going to do this or to move.
So when there were conflicts in your community, how did you folks come to a consensus or agreement? And since there were no leaders,
that's true.
Some meetings, what were they like?
The meetings were first of all, they were infrequent. We didn't meet nearly often enough. In a situation like that, we should have been meeting at least every week, in some kind of formal way. We tried to work things out by the most casual kind of consensus, I would say. I'd say consistently not making things clear, Eventually, we started to have, some sort of formal organizational structure. I think we started to actually to elect an abbot annually, and we started to adopt, some of the forms of the Quantum School of Zen. But the meetings were often contentious, and they were attended not only by the residents, of course, but by all members of the Zen Center. So that's an interesting situation also, and one that was never really made clear. Who is a member? How does the house function with respect to the larger Sangha? What is the relationship of this residential situation to the larger Sangha?
How many members do you have?
We probably had about 15 or 20 in those days, and 6 or 7 people, something like that, living in the house, something like that. And now we have 4 people living in the house and about 50 members. So it's clear now that our Sangha is based in the community, not in any kind of residential living situation. Whereas other Zen centers, such as the Cambridge Zen Center, will have 50 residents. And then maybe another 50 people who live in the community. So it would be quite a bit different. So in those days, we just tried to work things out as best we could while keeping things very democratic, very egalitarian. And with, I suppose, actively, if not completely consciously, just resisting, you know, any kind of hierarchical, you know, bureaucratic structure, which now we have in spades, you know, from Zen master on down. And members from time to time bring this up and plead for a more, you know, bottom to top model, or one that's really even. And sometimes we make some gesture in that direction, but it's pretty clear that we're going to stay with this this hierarchical model. Let me just get that. I forget what we were talking about. Do you have another question?
You were talking about now that you plan to stay in this hierarchical.
Yeah, this is the standard model in the Quantum School of Zen. We have, in fact, about 8 or 9 years ago, we adopted the common bylaws of the Quantum School of Zen. And those are incorporated into our own bylaws. You know, we have a board of directors, we have an executive committee, and so forth, and that's how we operate.
So I'm interested by what you said before. You started at that time, your community had voted an abbot.
Yeah.
So how did that work out in relation to rest of the people that were living in the center, the house?
Yeah, the I remember one meeting in particular. We were, you know, voting. I forget if we call it the president or the abbot. And I don't know, it was a bit of a farce, to tell you the truth, because everybody knew that the abbot or president really didn't have and wouldn't exercise any power, really, but would simply perform, you know, certain functions. I think the president or abbot at that time was also the treasurer, and I think that was the main function, was simply to write the checks, you know, pay the bills, keep the books, but would not actually you know, make any decisions or exercise any authority.
All of them were students of Sosan Nim?
Yes, okay. Right. Or became students, and, you know, as soon as they were members.
Okay.
At the very beginning, students from various teachers all came together, you know, just interested in forming some kind of practice group. But within a year or two, it was just Sunsin Im students, because he was the teacher who was willing to come here. And he came here every year. And he would lead a retreat and a precept ceremony. And none of the other teachers that these various people had studied with would ever come. And so it became, after a few years, It never was really an eclectic group, such as you find, you know, in some places, or ecumenical, except in the very early days.
Okay. So, besides the one-day retreat on a daily basis, everyone had jobs outside, or I'm not clear. Between the relationship of working on the house?
Oh, the working on the house was strictly volunteer, overtime work. That's all. Yeah.
So they had real jobs outside?
Everybody had real jobs outside.
Okay.
Yeah, everyone, I think.
I'm also interested in the children of the two couples. Were they real young? Did they have a sense of work? What was going on?
Well, when we started, one was, our son was 2 years old, and the Duermeyer son a little younger than that, maybe six months younger.
So they wouldn't have any memory or experience, or you wouldn't have any perception of how they related to all these people in the house?
No, I think You know, children that young will adapt to anything. But then when we left, by the time we left, our son was, you know, 4 years old. And the Durmeyers, if you wanted to talk to people who went through that, the Durmeyer children, there are three of them now. And all in their early years, you know, the Zen Center was at their house. They grew up in a Zen Center. And they do have memories of it. And I think they might be willing to talk about it as well.
I have a list of questions here. Just, you answered many of these questions already. One question was, what kind of literature influenced you as you began to live in the community? Was it, did you guys strictly read Songtsen Nim's books? Or you had a library of your own?
I wouldn't say we were very much influenced by any kind of literature,
okay,
really. At that time, Songtsen Nim had one book, Dropping Ashes on the Buddha.
Okay.
And we read that book. But there's no body of literature that really influenced us. I'd just say some general influences from, you know, the culture at large. You know, some sort of notion of, you know, living together and practicing together. But we got that more from Songtsen Nim's talks, really, his letters. So in a sense that maybe there was a body of literature, come to think of it, because besides his book, from the very early days, he would answer all of the letters that were written to him. And these were kept and bound and distributed to all the Zen centers. So eventually there were, I think there's 5,000 or 6,000 letters. And every day at practice, morning and night, one of these letters to him and his answer would be read. Yeah, it was really quite wonderful, and he did that. And several books have been generated out of those letters since then. But I think those letters probably influenced us more than anything. In terms of literature.
Can you talk a little about the practice that you did? You mentioned that people that went to the community had previous experiences with Zen.
Mm-hmm.
Did they all practice the method that Songtsen Nim taught? How did they convert to that method? And what did you guys actually do when you sat, did prostrations, chanted?
Yeah, well, by the time we had this house, in fact, even before that, I would say after the, we started in 1978, and by the early in 1978, by the end of 1978, we were strictly doing the practice in the Kwannon School of Zen that Songtsen Nim, you know, had developed, adapting it from traditional, you know, Korean monastic practices. So in the morning, starting at 5:15, we would do the four great vows, which set the direction for the practice, and then 108 prostrations, doing this all together. And then chanting for about 45 minutes, and then a half hour of sitting. And then in the evening, at 7 o'clock, a half hour of chanting and a half hour of sitting. That's the standard daily practice. Eventually we modified the morning practice to a 1 hour practice, starting at 6. So we would do the four great vows, 108 prostrations, 15 or 20 minutes of chanting, and the half hour of sitting.
Can you just briefly mention what the four great vows are and how people related to those vows?
Yes. These vows are common to all of the Mahayana schools of Buddhism. So throughout China, Japan, Korea, Tibet, even. And they are, sentient beings are numberless, we vow to save them all. Delusions are endless, we vow to cut through them all. The teachings are infinite, we vow to learn them all. The Buddha way is inconceivable, we vow to attain it. I'm sure you know these vows, perhaps in a slightly different translation. Actually, the original form of the second vow was not delusions are endless, we vow to cut through them all, but passions are endless, we vow to extinguish them all. And since you asked how people relate to these vows, I thought I would bring up that point. Both translations are valid. As you know, we're translating here the Sanskrit word klesha. The Chinese, we pronounce it bone, you would say fun. Fun now. Fun now, yeah, okay. So, passions, delusions, klesha. We take these vows very seriously, and the first vow especially sets the bodhisattva way. This practice is for all beings. Saying that first thing in the morning, as soon as you get up, really hits your heart, very hard. And then when we would translate it passions, passions are endless. So as soon as you wake up, I don't want to do this, and everything is revolting, So, okay. And then the teachings are infinite. We always understood that as teachings, not so much as dogma or things that you would read or Buddhist doctrine, but that this practice itself is teaching us. Our life experience is always teaching us. So we're going to get through this horrible day of whatever we're going to do, renovating the house and all of these experiences. Each teaching is like a Dharma gate, because that's what the word is, really, bonbon. It's all teaching. So this, all of this we're going through is teaching. And then finally, the Buddha way is inconceivable. We vow to attain it. I like that translation, inconceivable. It's actually musang. There's nothing higher than the Buddha way. But for some reason, we translated it as inconceivable, which had this way of just cutting off all thinking. He says, well, like, okay, I'll never understand this, to hell with it. I'm going to do it anyway. So the sheer impossibility, they're all expressed in terms of ultimates and impossibilities, and it's inconceivable, it's impossible, it's infinite, but we're going to do it anyway. Really was taken very seriously by all of us. Still, even when we do these vows today, some of us have been doing them for over 20 years, every time, it's, okay. And it is the first thing you do in the morning. So those vows were a really important part of the practice. Only takes a minute, but it's probably the most important part, because it set the direction for not only the formal practice, but for your entire life. And we all really believe that.
So those ideas really held the group together.
Yeah, they really did. I mean, there was friction and dissension and so forth. But they really have held the group together.
You mentioned about the method, you practice sitting and so on. What method did a participant actually do?
Of the many meditation methods for sitting meditation were perfectly acceptable. In our school, we teach three basic forms. One is actually mantra. So the very rapid recitation of a mantra, like Kwan Tsen Boso, Kwan Tsen Boso, Kwan Tsen Boso, Kwan Tsen Boso, faster than that, faster than you can say it. This practice is like a washing machine on the spin cycle. So going around very, very, very fast, all the dirty water goes out, but the center is not moving. And that's very common in our school. Mantra practice. There's also the Watto method, where you take a question and reduce it to its essence and just perceive that. So an example of that would be on the inhalation, asking, what am I? And on the exhalation, don't know. What am I? Don't know. And that's done in coordination with the breath.
It is or is not?
Is. Yeah, that is done in coordination with the breath. Variations, any kind of variation on that is, anything that works is perfectly all right. So we encourage students to maybe find their own great question. It's either what is this or why does it hurt, some variation of that. So working with the great question. And then there are very simple forms, such as simply observing the breath, simply counting the breath, something like that. These are traditional and common to most schools. So there's no one method that people are they're really instructed to follow. Rather, people are encouraged to experiment and find something that works. So various methods are offered, and the students are encouraged after, you know, some period of experimentation to find one and stay with it, and not always to be changing.
So since there are no leaders, spiritual leader, per se, in the community, when people have difficulties in practice, did you have group meetings and share experiences, or how was it?
Oh, well, in those days, the days that I was referring to, there was no leader. Teachers would visit. So within the Quantum School of Zen, there were, even then, when we started, authorized teachers. So at first it was Zen Master Sung San, and he would come around to all the Zen centers. But in 1978, in fact, or maybe a year before that, he gave Inca to two of his senior students. And they would come out here, as well as go to other Zen centers. So you would actually save your questions, any difficulties that you had with practice, until a teacher came. So there was no group discussion. There was, however, from the very beginning, the phenomenon of the Dharma talk, where relatively inexperienced students would be asked to give a 5-minute talk. So the typical part of the practice, it was a typical part of practice, after the formal meditation period, a letter from De Sensenim would be read, and whoever read the letter would then put the book down and then give like a 5-minute talk, always simply based on your own experience. Nothing that you learned from a book or anything like that, just your experience with practice. It wasn't that you had any answers, maybe just presenting your difficulties. But then there was no discussion after that. So this tradition of Dharma talks has continued in the school. Now it's just once a week that we do it. And it's usually for people who are a little more experienced now. Of course, now in our Zen center, there are in fact 3 teachers with Inca and 1 Zen master, so now all of that has changed. There is very much, there's a teacher in residence now. But in those days there wasn't. We depended upon visiting teachers for that sort of thing, and for work with kongans, which is another meditation technique, and which can only be done with an authorized teacher.
What were the economic arrangements at that time?
Well, we had a formal economic arrangement, that is a legal contract. We were all equally co-owners of the house and all responsible for any kind of bills that had to be paid. So we all simply put in equal amounts. And that never was a problem. The economics of it were never a problem.
So the money wasn't held in common, but everyone put the same amount in?
Everyone put the same amount in, yes.
Okay.
But we all had our own personal incomes, and it's not like we pooled all of our resources together.
So who made the spending decisions for what was needed at the house? I guess everyone just voted?
Everyone. We would decide in a very informal way, we need to do this, so let's go spend the money. All right, do it.
Oh, can you talk about membership? How did one become a member?
Yeah, even at that time, you became a member actually by joining the Quantum School of Zen.
Okay.
And half the dues that were paid would go to the school and half to the local Zen center. So it was always a member of joining the school, actually. That's how you joined an individual Zen center. So there was a dues-paying structure. And come to think of it, it hasn't changed for 20 years. It's still $20 a month. Maybe it's time for dues to go up. But that's what it was. It was $20 a month. And so there was some income from dues, and sometimes we would make some money from retreats. Usually we went into the hole for a retreat because you had to fly a teacher in, pay the teacher's stipend, pay for all the food, so that we usually lost money on retreats.
What was it like with your neighbors? Did they know what you were doing?
Our neighbors knew what we were doing, and in that neighborhood nobody cared.
Okay.
This is a student ghetto neighborhood, so anything goes. This is no problem.
Were there any precepts people had to take in order to live there? For example, no drugs or alcohol or anything like that, or was it allowed, or was no rule whatsoever?
Actually, at that time, we had almost no rules. People who took precepts would take the five precepts, which would include, you know, no drugs and so forth. And mostly we all simply abided by that, but we were never very strict about it. Sometimes, you know, we would drink wine or beer, and it was never a problem. Probably some people, maybe some marijuana every now and then, but that was a very, very small part of the culture of the, you know, the people who were associating with this. It was never a problem, and we never even discussed it.
Okay. Well, did you have any contact besides the Providence Zen Center, the headquarters? Was there any relation, contact?
With other Zen centers?
With other Zen centers and also with the headquarters?
Yeah, well, Providence Zen Center was the headquarters. But we were also were associated personally, through personal contacts, I mean, with Empty Gate Zen Center in San Francisco, or rather in Berkeley, and with the Cambridge Zen Center in Boston. Some of us had been to those places and practiced there, and we knew the people there. And to a certain, to a lesser extent, with the Zen Center in Los Angeles and in New York and New Haven. But these were just casual contacts.
Were there any unforgettable characters living there? As someone that you stand on, thinking back at that time with the six or seven of you, was there some, like, a person that was...
No, there was...
Stood out?
No one who was really eccentric or put himself forward in any way like that. I think maybe Jim Binger would be the closest to that. He's the one who eventually became a monk and a Zen master and the abbot of the entire school.
I think he's fair skinned.
Yeah.
Pale, white, tall.
Yeah. And you may have seen him around.
Yeah. I went to Korea with him.
You went to Korea with him? when you were looking around.
Yeah, there was the world as a single flower.
Whole world as a single flower? Yeah. Maybe that would have been in what, 91 or 88 or? 89? What would that
yeah,
have been?
Yeah, early like that.
Something like that, yeah. That's interesting.
What were some of the benefits of, were there any benefits of living here?
Just supporting the practice, that's all. Any benefits had simply to do with the meditation practice. Otherwise it was all headaches. No, we were, that's exaggerating, we were all good friends. We enjoyed each other's company, just in a normal human way. It was a good thing to do.
Yeah, I know in community living, things can become very intensified.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's interesting, your teacher talked about the potatoes.
Why yeah.
Potatoes as this analogy. My teacher used to use chopsticks.
Chopsticks, rubbing?
Yeah. He didn't put it in a sense of friction and rubbing. He used to say that, you know, if you tie a whole, how would you call it, a whole
a bundle?
Bunch,
yeah.
Bundle of chopsticks together, or logs, it will flow very strongly down the river.
Uh-huh.
But if you just untie the rope, just have them go their own ways, they'll get stuck. Everyone will get stuck.
Everyone will get stuck.
Yeah. By the canals.
That's good. I like that.
By the side rocks.
Yeah.
But if they tie together, they just
yeah. They all get down to the ocean.
Even if one of those chunks was very bad, or even a few of them, or even all of them were bad.
Yeah.
You tie them together.
That's
go
good.
Fine.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that phrase "together action." When we were on one of these whole world conferences in Korea recently, you know how these things are. You're always getting on a bus and going somewhere, and after a week you're so tired all being together. And one morning at breakfast, he could see us thinking. We were supposed to go to some place, and we were all thinking, I'm going to go somewhere else. I'm going to go sneak out. And he looked at us all and says, "Together action, even if you die."
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good teaching.
The idea of Sangha.
Yeah, idea of Sangha.
How is your life after community being affected?
After communal living?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, it was.
What do you think about, for example, what do you think about the idea of Sangha and community living in terms of Buddhism?
Well, maybe I don't understand exactly what you're asking. How was my perception of Sangha and community living with Buddhism affected by my experience of this community living? Yeah. It really heightened. I had never done any kind of community living in my life. During the 60s and early 70s, I had many opportunities to do so because it was very common then. But I never wanted to do it. It was only when I became really committed to the practice that I wanted to do it for the sake of the practice. Then when I went through it, I had a much deeper understanding of Sangha and its importance in Buddhism. You know, it's one of the three jewels. There's, you know, the Buddha, which is our original mind, and the Dharma, which is the truth of the universe. You know, so like most Americans, I'm very much an individualist, and I associated, you know, this kind of community with loss of individualism, and this is really more Confucian than Buddhist anyway, and you know, I don't care. But, you know, then I would, you know, hear stories about, oh, how monks actually live, say, in China, you know. And Korea, where they all, you know, sleep so closely together so that if one person turns over, they all have to turn over. So how horrible. But then I would hear, oh no, but the young monks want that experience. They regard that as the most important part of their training. So I got a, you know, some kind of appreciation for, you know, what that is all about and how really Sangha is the fulfillment of this first vow. You know, sentient beings are numberless. We vow to save them all. That is, you have to be willing to go into any situation and completely enter into it with other people, with other beings, so that the bodhisattva, even if you go to hell, that's okay. You know, you just do the communal action, you know, down in hell.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's okay. So that I would find myself psychologically actually creating Sangha, this kind of more or less intense communal living in other situations in my life, just seeing them as Sangha and as productive in that way. You know, I was department chair of my department for 16 years, and I don't think I would have survived without this notion of Sangha. You know, so, 'cause that was its own Sangha, but its direction wasn't clear. And so my job was always to try to give it, you know, some kind of direction, you know, as department chair. And so it influenced my life, you know, in many ways, really.
Do you have any documents from your communal living that you can share? Did you have a copy of a liturgy that I can copy sometime later, or something that you, some other kind of document?
Well, you know, an important document for all of this, and something else I should bring up, and you can have a copy of it, is what we call the temple rules.
Devised during that time, or?
They were devised, no, by Zen Master Sung San when he set up, you know, this practice. He is adapting it from, you know, some monastic model, and ultimately it goes back to old China, where all of this was developed. You know, these rules for communal living, and even the very retreat schedule that we had, you know, ultimately is, you know, Tang Dynasty material.
Are you talking about the pure rules?
Yeah, sometimes I call that.
Yeah.
Okay. This is it's maybe 8 pages.
Okay.
But it's what Dei Sensei would always do, I would see him doing this, like when he'd be sitting on a sofa visiting, you know, for a while, and he'd have all these big, thick books around him, and he'd be writing out, I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm just taking out the best parts. So, he would make extracts from,
okay.
So, And so he came up with the temple rules. And they're really quite wonderful. I think he may, I would like for you to look at this and tell me what you think of it and how it relates to other, you know, documents like that that you know about. We read them at the beginning of every retreat. And they are rules for living together and for keeping a strong practice mind in every situation. And the way it interweaves, you know, communal living, together action, practicing together, with, you know, the mind that practices to see original nature, is, I think, very beautiful. And that's the one document I would give you, because it's one that, it's another, well, piece of literature, if you want, that has strongly influenced all of us. Maybe I can give it to you. I might have a copy here.
The other communities that you visited, well, you have visited other Buddhist communities, mm-hmm. and has that influenced your structure now with the Zen Center? Or has it primarily come from Providence?
It comes from the school,
okay.
Yeah. Right now, you know, we're setting up more of a residential model at our Zen Center, and all we did, we took the rules at the Providence Zen Center and just adapted them a little. But we did, in fact, make a special visit when we were thinking of this to a Soto Zen Center in Minnesota. It's called Clouds in Water. And it's a breakaway group from the Minnesota Zen Center, which was Katagiri Roshi's Zen Center. They were not happy with the way that Zen Center was run. So they moved to St. Paul, and they set up their own Zen Center. It's not residential at all, and it's in a public building downtown, in a community building where they're able to rent inexpensively. And their programs are set up so that there's something for everybody in the community. Everything from the training to become a priest in that school is available there to, you know, what you might regard as the sort of thing that any Protestant church in this country might offer in terms of community programs and things like that. So they become kind of this full service Zen center. And the abbot and I visited that place to see, well, what can we learn from this? And maybe we got some ideas, more in the terms of the programs that we might be offering rather than in how we come together to practice and so forth.
Are there any last anecdotes that you'd like to share or experiences from that time?
Well, I can, yeah, there's one that I can tell you about, and it's a reflection upon that time, although the anecdote comes from our 20th anniversary celebration a couple of years ago. So this Jim Binger comes back for this celebration, because he's the school abbot now and one of the original members, and he gave a talk. And he talked about the early days, since we were reminiscing, the 20 years. And he said, this Zen Center from its beginning has always been a mistake. So, in fact, we should call it the Original Mistake Zen Center, because all we did through the years was make one mistake after another. But somehow, because our direction was strong, we were able to use these mistakes to make our situation correct. And finally, maybe that's happening. And I would say, looking back, that that's true. That all we did was make one mistake after another, and it's a miracle that we survived. So that's not an anecdote, but it might be a way of summing up the experience.
Great. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure, well, thank you. Yeah. It was fun.